say a little bit of that in the very beginning. Good morning. Are schools geared to girls? That's an essential question researchers on boys' education are asking. Today, Paul Burgess of St. Andrew's School for Boys looks at some of the recent data. And 10 days after the release of Apple Pay, the list of retailers who won't accept it has been growing. Bite Marks Cafe's Ryan Ozawa considers who those stores may be hurting. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. It's Thursday, October 30th, and it's The Conversation.
And the benefits of cultural tourism may not be the first thing visitors to Hawaii stop to consider, but a visiting speaker at the inaugural Hawaii Heritage and Hospitality Forum says it ought to be. We'll talk with Andrew Witt, and I'm Chris Vandercook, and a case in point might be the preservation of the ancient art of Hawaiian puppetry. Master craftsman Calvin Hoy will speak at International Waikiki Hula Conference. First, he'll talk to us. Next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, before we get into the conversation for this morning, just want to give you a quick update about the lava. About an hour ago, there was a briefing with Hawaii Civil Defense Chief Daryl Oliveira, and at the moment, he says that the lava is about 155 meters, that would be about 500 feet, from Pahoa Village Road. Clearly, though, this is a good thing so far that we've only seen one structure, Chris, that has gone down, that shed, and obviously it's moving into areas that in which people reside. But thankfully, nothing that we've seen yet where houses have erupted in flames, and it's moving a little bit more slowly this morning. So we'll be waiting and watching and seeing what happens today, as we do every single day, and see how everyone over there is being able to cope with this in some way, and all the emotions that are surging along with the creeping of the lava.
Yeah, it's close to impossible to predict, so you just have to watch.
And we are, and we'll continue to do that too. And thanks very much to Sherry Bracken and Molly Solomon, who let us know what things are looking like right this morning. Now, if you bought an iPhone 6, you were likely told that it had a payment capability that previous versions didn't. 10 days ago, Apple Pay became available, and a lot of people had been eagerly anticipating it. Since then, some big retailers have announced they weren't going to take it because they had their own app, and they were had their own app had its own method of payment. Before Bite Marks Cafe co-host Ryan Ozawa left for a family holiday yesterday, I asked him whether the retailer's reaction was mean-spirited or if something else was going on.
Well, you know, Apple Pay is actually using a standard that's been around for a while called NFC. And if you used certain apps on an Android phone for the last couple of years, you could use it at any place with a modern terminal that you could use NFC payments. But Apple Pay definitely made it more mainstream. The thing that the retailers are trying to avoid are credit card charge fees. That's 1% to 5% of every transaction. That's why some stores against credit card policy say you have to pay a certain amount or buy a certain amount to use a credit card. So merchants or retailers are getting together and saying, let's do our own system that sidesteps the credit cards so we can save that money. So they don't want you to use something like Apple Pay, which basically supports the existing system that people are used to, where they take that fee and let us get straight to your bank account through ACH, and nobody pays fees, so we get more money. That's the retailer's point of view. I would say, though, that it's not a friendly position to take for consumers.
Not very much at all, if you consider how many people are very concerned that somebody might use access to their account to take more than necessarily what they're supposed to be taking. That's why very often consumers are told, don't use your check card. Make sure you use a credit card, because then you've got a buffer between you and your account and money.
Right. Actually, a significant part of the reason why you pay that credit card fee is for those fraud protections. And I am someone who used my debit card combination credit card, and it got you know, taken, it got used by a fraudster, and that takes money right out of your checking account, and the recourse there is much more dangerous for you than a credit card. So I certainly wouldn't be interested in using a brand new payment system that a retailer came up with that goes straight to my bank account. And what I find fascinating is they think this is something that consumers will adopt, but the primary motivator is to make the merchants happy, not the consumer.
Well, didn't we always say that the consumer is always right? Whatever happened to that?
Well, there is sort of a small, as with anything on the internet these days, there's now a movement. It's called Pay It Safe. And basically people who have Apple Pay or Google Wallet or all of these standard-based NFC phone-based payment systems, they're saying, well, I'm not going to CVS. I'm not going to Rite Aid. I'm going to Walgreens. Walgreens is embracing Apple Pay, so that's where I'm going to go buy my toilet paper and my cough drops.
In effect, it becomes a marketing driver.
I think so. And I think that, you know, the thing about the system that the merchants are coming up with, one, it's not available. It won't be available until next year. So they've cut off this Apple Pay availability, even though they don't have the alternative. The other thing is that what the merchants want you to do is use QR codes and take a picture at the register or scan your phone with a scanner. I mean,
not going to happen.
Not convenient. The thing about Apple Pay and NFC is that it's literally so fast. Sometimes when I bought my first sandwich at McDonald's, I couldn't believe that I was done when I paid. It's even faster than a credit card or a debit card or a PIN number. So you get convenience, you get speed, and you get security. None of the things that what the merchant system, when it becomes available, will be able to provide for you.
The merchant system, as you just mentioned, isn't going to be available until next year. And these very same merchants are declining to accept Apple Pay. And they're doing this right before the peak holiday season. Not a smart idea.
Well, I think that what actually is going to be the dangerous place to be is somewhere in the Christmas shopping season when I could not use Apple Pay or a Google Wallet and I had to pull out that old-fashioned credit card with a number that is the only important thing about my money. And then find out that, oops, sorry, there was a breach. We need to issue a new card. Sorry, there were fraudulent charges. So not only are we seeing more and more of these breaches, but now these merchants are allowing a possibility for these breaches when there was a secure, safe, fast, convenient alternative right there already working.
So we seem to see three strikes you're out here. That issue that you just talked about, that this thing may, in fact, if you have to whip out a credit card, get heisted by somebody else in some sort of hacking that we've yet to see that would rival some of the stuff we saw last year. Also, the fact that it's inconvenient to have to do all of this and that you don't even have a system that is available unless it's, Apple Pay at those places that would take it. Doesn't that bode ill for those retailers who are not accepting Apple Pay? I mean, is this not a message that they're getting clearly?
I think they might. I mean, of course, the question is this a tempest in a teapot? There weren't very many Google Wallet users. There are only iPhone 6 and 6 Plus users for Apple Pay. But those are consumers that generally have a lot of money, drive a lot of buying power. And again, if it was a head-to-head competition between the merchant solution, which is CurrentC, and Apple Pay, then may the best system win. The ones that consumers want to use is the one they'll use. But it really seems, I mean, you can get the CurrentC app now, and because of this decision to block it, even though the terminals would work, people are giving that app one-star reviews by the thousands. So they've actually, I think, shot themselves in the foot.
Which sort of leads me to the bottom line question. Is this thing really going to survive, or is Apple just going to bide its time and wait for all of this to peter out and find themselves with something that's really quite valuable and appreciated by consumers?
I think that people, the merchants trying to stick with the solution that they've not deployed yet, are going to be on the losing side of this because consumers shop where they will. And already I know that I want to go use this. I want to be a nerd, so I'm going to shop places where I can use them. The fact of the matter is they're going to know when they see those very current, VeriSign or Verifone terminals on the register that it should work, but it's being blocked. I mean, I'm feeling that there's hostility there that shouldn't be there. So I would say that when CurrentC comes out and Walmart says, try our system, all you have to do is put in your bank account information, then launch the app when you get to the store and scan it with a little screen and point it at the QR code. I mean, nobody is actually going to do that. It'll be a very short lifespan for them.
So what universe are they living in that makes them think that this is going to work? Because the way you describe it sounds like the biggest a waste of my time as a consumer and not something that would make me feel particularly charitable toward the retailer making me do that.
I think the currency system was doomed from the start because its reason for existing was to sidestep credit card fees in favor of the merchants. It's a battle that's real. Small businesses will know that credit card fees are an issue. But when that's the reason why a product exists rather than serving the customer, it's a non-starter from the start.
Does that mean that we're going to see checks coming back at all? I mean, I've had retailers tell me, you know, the credit card thing, if you really want to do that, it's fine. But if you could give us a check, that would be so much better for us.
Well, people who are interested in security and privacy, they're going back to cash. I know friends that now they try to live that way entirely because they don't want either merchants or the credit card companies or their phone manufacturers knowing what they buy. So I think cash could make a comeback of all things. I still carry a checkbook. And I think that those are all solutions. Even when you're waiting for change or trying to write out your check and getting your ID, that'll still be more convenient than what the merchants want you to do. So why not support Apple Pay with the hardware you've already brought, renovated and brought in, and let me tap and get out and actually serve more customers and make more money?
If you're going to do that. If not, then cash is still king.
I think so.
All right, Ryan, thanks so much for coming, and we'll talk to you soon. And have a good holiday. You're about to head off.
That's right, off to Orlando. Thank you.
Ryan Ozawa is the Director of Communications at Hawaii Information Service, co-founder of Hawaii Open Data, and co-host of HPR2's Bite Marks Cafe.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and later in the show, we'll look at the islands as a different kind of travel destination. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're going back to the origins of the shipping business in Hawaii. In 1882, Captain William Matson began sailing to Hawaii from San Francisco. The first voyage to Hawaii carried 300 tons of food, plantation supplies, and general merchandise on the schooner Emma Claudina. And the return voyage exported sugar to the mainland. Over the years, Matson expanded his shipping fleet with bigger ships, including those with technical innovations, cold storage, electric lights, and ships fueled by oil instead of steam. Captain Matson also expanded his business portfolio by dabbling in oil exploration, luxury ocean liners, and hotels. When William Matson died, he had 14 ships in his fleet that carried both goods and passengers. For your quiz today, we're interested in the year that Captain Matson died. If you know the answer, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation. We'll see who knows a little history or who Googled the answer next half hour.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Our Kaka'ako, a new nine-block community by Kamehameha Schools designed for visionary urban island living. OurKaka'ako.com.
Hawaii offers a vast number of cultural and historical resources. There's no place quite like it in the world. But tourists rarely hear about the unique story of Hawaii. Instead, they think of it as a leisure destination, a place to get away from it all. Are we selling ourselves short in more ways than one? Andrew Witt, executive director of the St. John's Cultural Council in Florida, is a visiting speaker at the inaugural Hawaii Heritage and Hospitality Forum. He thinks that might be the case. He's in town to talk about the benefits, economic and otherwise, of heritage and cultural tourism, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
It's good to have you. When people go to France or Italy, the fact that they're going to take part in something we might call cultural tourism is pretty much taken for granted. It's an automatic part of the experience, yeah?
Absolutely. Of course, Europe's had a lot more years than we've had here in the United States. Although in my hometown of St. Augustine,
you've got
America's first place city, we are celebrating our 450th anniversary next year. And that is really my focus in my current position as head of the Arts Council.
Mm-hmm.
We are marketing the cultural and heritage tourism assets in Florida to promote St. Augustine, to get the textbooks rewritten, to accurately reflect the founding of America, but also as an economic generator, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. And as an economic generator, it attracts a different type of tourist entirely, yeah?
Correct. What we've found is that there are basically five segments to the tourism market. And at one end, for lack of a better term, I would call them the seekers, those people who actually want to go out and experience the interesting things that they didn't know ahead of time. And Hawaii's full of those. As I was preparing to come over here, I Googled a few things and I found out you have a palace, mm-hmm. a royal palace. There is no other royal palace in the United States. Of course, you have volcanoes and you have pineapple farms, but I'm really anxious to find out what else I don't know about Hawaii.
And I
know there's a lot of other people who are.
I suspect that and you're going to be taken on a kind of a crash tour today in advance of your speaking at the event tomorrow. And I suspect there are going to be a lot of things that you had no idea about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've traveled all over the United States. I spent some time in the Northwest in Seattle. And I always tried to find those things that were not necessarily offbeat, but that other people didn't know about, because it helped me gain the knowledge about the world and the condition of people around the country. And I think there are a lot of folks like me and like you and like others who are like that and are interested in coming to places that are not the plastic, what we might refer to as the Disney-fied attractions that we have in Florida or that exist in other parts of the country.
Well, certainly one thing that you hear about tourism in Hawaii is that we offer experiences that you could get in other places, and maybe even get in other places more cheaply.
That's true. But
sun, sand, and surf.
But part of our responsibility from the cultural and heritage world, in effect, the arts organizations, the heritage sites, the historic sites, is to differentiate those from those other places in the United States or in the world. That is our job, is in effect, we from our side, we call it product development.
Mm-hmm.
How do you create the authentic product that's going to engage that tourist and have him or her want to stay longer, spend a little more money, and get the economic gain from that perspective?
Maybe even come back.
And come back. And another reason to come back, because in many places there are so many things going on that you simply can't see them in one day or 2 days or even a week.
Sure. Well, it also it brings up the question of what kind of vacation do you want, you know, because some people approach their vacation as, I'm not going to do a thing for 2 weeks, you know, I'm going to sleep in and then, zone out on the beach and then have a big dinner and then start the cycle all over again. That may be, I think some people may find that gets old after about day three.
Absolutely. I mean, in Florida, we find that people get sunburned. Yeah.
So they can't
stay at the beach.
The
or
second
they can't
day.
Stay on the golf course. They've got to do something else. And so we want to capture that. But there is a whole segment of the market that really is interested in authentic, engaging activities that will make a difference. And they do want to come back. And it's not a million people. It's probably tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people over the course of the year. And those are the people that we want to target. There are, like many people in the arts world, we know that some people like opera, some people don't like opera. Some people like live theater, some
right.
people like dance. You're simply not going to appeal to everybody, but let's find a way to appeal to those who will be supportive of our activities and want to come back.
Well, you know, you also have the growth of interest in things like hula. We'll be talking about that later in the show, all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, I was fascinated by that conversation. I've known hula as, you know, something I see during a football game, during the NFL Pro Bowl, and a few commercials. But now I really understand, just in a very short conversation, that it's far, far greater in depth and meaningful than that. And so I'm anxious to learn more about that.
Well, is it harder to, you know, you're talking about introducing a more complex subject versus a more simple one. Is it a little more difficult to introduce it because of that?
Only if you make it complex. It really is a simple story. One of the things I'm going to talk about in my talk tomorrow is I'm going to start with, did you know?
Yeah.
Let me tell you a story. And that's how we are communicating about our culture, about our arts organization, about our historic site, or anything. It's the crazy uncle. let me tell you a story about Uncle Harry. People want to hear stories, and they want to know what the truth is. And the best way to communicate is to tell a story that's meaningful and personal and engaging.
Fair enough, Andy. Good to talk to you. Thanks.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Andrew Wood is the executive director of the St. John's Cultural Council in Florida. He's one of the plenary speakers at the inaugural Hawaii Heritage and Hospitality Forum, and that's tomorrow at the Hawaii Convention Center. You can learn more at hpr2.org.
I want my 150 meg TV.
People are signing up for broadband, so the broadband becomes the key here. That's where the net neutrality rules come in right now.
A national town meeting about net neutral broadband has 3.7 million voices and counting. Dollars or democracy, the broadband choice, next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This program is brought to you with pride by Hawaii Public Radio's members, volunteers, and community partners. Mahalo to Green Path Technologies, the School for Examining Essential Questions of Sustainability, and Town Restaurant. Thank you all for seeing us safely through Celebration 2014.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
Polls, polls, polls. It's the season, and lately we've talked about quite a few. But Civil Bee reporter Chad Blair says he's come to a conclusion about polls, and he joins us now with a reality check on why public opinion polls suck. Good morning.
Can we say that kind of word on public radio? I guess we just
We can
did.
Say a lot of words on public radio, just not the ones that the FCC will ding us for, but okay. Suck is okay. But I should say that's exactly how you've titled your article for today. And it seems kind of interesting that you would say this now after we've seen so many polls come out of Civil Beat. Did this put you at odds at all with the fact that you're doing all of these polls?
Well, there is certainly that. So when I write these poll stories, as we did this week on the governor's race, on the congressional races, on the ballot question number 4, you know, I always get calls from people complaining about them. If you're the front runner, if you come out in first place, you're pretty happy. We polled the race and said you're going to win, but you're kind of always looking over your shoulder to make sure that happens. And if you don't win as big as we said you'd win, then you feel like maybe you let people down. And if you're in second place, you feel like, hey, maybe I have a chance. People will give me a look. But if you're in third place, oh, you feel terrible. I mean, who's going to vote for you? Because they're going to think that they're wasting their vote. So what I'm trying to say in this article and speaking to you this morning is I feel the frustration people have over polls. They're kind of self-fulfilling prophecies, manufactured news on the part of the media. And that includes us at Civil Beat.
Would you say that if we had more tracking polls?
Well, certainly those tracking polls are not going to stop. And the media doesn't, at least the local media, doesn't normally report on them nationally. Oh, those things are every day. I mean, look at the U.S. Senate races. Everyone's trying to find out who's going to win. And there's, you know, all sorts of polls all over the place. They are not going to go away anytime soon because people like to read these things. I can tell you that the polls, or rather that the campaigns locally, they can afford it. They do their own polling. They may not release the results, but they are definitely trying to keep track of where their person is.
As you just said that, that people are interested in them, that sort of becomes also its own self-fulfilling prophecy that we will have more polls. But we always say these are just snapshots in time, and they could be mitigated by events that happen after those polls have been taken, and also by how truthful people are when those polls are taken too.
Right. And some experts have said that you can't really poll places like Hawaii, that it's very difficult for this reason or that. Generally, our polls have been accurate. And I speak for all the local polls here. Sure, we've had some doozies that were way off, but more or less, we've got them right. But the question is, why do we bother publishing them? Because, like I said, it makes some people feel really good, other people's terrible. Does it turn people off from voting? I guess that's my ultimate question.
And what happens when you're already in a period where people are already going to the polls and the fact that they're walking in?
Right, and they've already started polling. And what if you see a headline that says your guy's going to lose? Do you then say, well, I'm not going to throw away my vote. I'm going to go for the winner, even though that's not my favorite candidate. I mean, these are big deals. They have a lot of influence on the way we vote, I think.
All right, well, we'll wait and
or
see.
Or not vote.
whether that's true or not. We'll talk more about this perhaps after the election. Thanks very
Thanks,
much,
Beth
Chad.
Ann.
Talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Beth Ann, tonight at 5, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and this is a really good opportunity for an in-depth conversation, isn't it?
Well, the conversation is going to be with Duke Iona. As you know, over the last several weeks, we've been talking to the gubernatorial candidates. We've already spoken to Senator Ige and to Mufi Hanneman last week, and this week we're going to talk to Duke Iona. And the whole point of it is that, you know, we've seen a whole lot of debates. I mean, really, they are just so much so that I think someone made a joke this morning that the candidates are thinking that they can now answer each other's questions.
Sure.
But are they really an opportunity for people to ask questions and have a deep answer and have a bit of a conversation? Not really when you're really bound by time, and certainly we're bound by time too, but having access to Duke Iona tonight is what we're going to offer with a conversation on Town Square.
It's a chance to stretch out and for the candidates to get off script a little bit, yeah?
Well, that's what we're hoping, absolutely. I mean, obviously, their plans are their plans and their talking points are their talking points, but sometimes things happen in conversation that really gives you a different shade of someone's personality and how they would be effective or maybe not effective as a candidate. We're going to give you the opportunity to make your own choice tonight when you call in and talk with Duke Iona tonight at 5 on Town Square.
Thanks, Bethany.
If you have a school-aged son, you might want to stop a moment to consider this. Girls outperform boys in grades at all levels. Yeah, girls. And not just in the U.S., but countries around the world, from the U.K. to Hong Kong. That's part of the latest data from an analysis by the American Psychological Association of a University of New Brunswick study on gender differences. Those differences have turned attention back to boys, including in Honolulu. Paul Burgess is the director of the St. Andrews Preparatory School for Boys, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Hey, Beth Ann. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, good to talk to you. We talk about boys and girls, you know, but looking at these gender differences and have done that for quite some time. A lot of the experts on boys are saying that, you know, we spent so much time diverting our attention to deficits with girls, or what we thought were deficits with girls, that we completely forgot the boys.
Yeah.
And now we have a lot of ground to make up for
that. Sure, sure. Well, and I think that focus with the girls, you know, the consequence of that was an environment that was really conducive for girls more so than boys.
You're talking about in the classroom or the school setting in general?
Yeah, well, I think everything. Outside at recess, in the classroom environment, boys tend to be really active. And just the way they play can be aggressive. And I think it can be overwhelming for girls at times. And so some of the policies put in place, you know, look at academic approach and even play policy, I think had changed a lot in the 80s and 90s. And unfortunately for boys, it wasn't conducive to how they develop and how they learn and how they grow. And so after looking at the research, we realized there's really a need out there to help boys. You've talked about some of the statistics. And boys, we found that through the research, boys fall behind, especially in the elementary age, school age years. So by fourth grade, that's where that big gap, especially in reading, occurs. So kids learn when they're engaged, when they're having fun, when they're enjoying school.
And a lot of boys are kinesthetic learners anyway.
Absolutely.
They need to be moving and standing, which is why some of the best brain guys have said, you know, those desks that you stick them in, not such a good idea.
Yeah, so if you come to our classroom, that's one thing you will not see. Desks and students sitting in one place for a very long period of time. Now, of course, that is part of school. So we do have moments where the boys understand time and place where we do need to sit. For instance, chapel, we have chapel once a week. But as far as learning, we need boys to collaborate. We need boys to be curious. We need boys to understand their own interests and passions. And that takes interacting with others.
But don't they kind of do that anyway? I mean, we've seen how, you know, guys get together and work on a project or just seem interested, or the way guys used to go off and play. I mean, there have been some, you know, lovely shows where we've seen that and what childhood kind of used to be compared to what childhood is now.
Right.
But the real essence of a lot of the criticism is that we've tried to make classrooms fit the way, you know, girls learn, and that we've moved from the needs of one sex and disadvantaging the other, whichever way you go.
Yeah.
But yet we still have, Paul, this same stereotype that persists that, you know, boys are much better in science and math,
and
girls are much better with language arts.
Right.
And that's simply not true when you look at 100 years worth of data, as this study has.
Right. Well, and back on that point, you talked about the fact that students are having to sit in these environments that are conducive for girls. Where's the collaboration going on there? Where is the teamwork involved? Where is the, you know, we have an EDP process with the school, which engineering design process, where you know, we're teaching students to identify a problem, collaborate to make kind of a plan to approach it, and then try it and then retest it. I mean, that happens when students can move and engage and do those things. So I think, again, the traditional system doesn't allow for that. And so we're changing that aspect of it. And then also, you look at the amount of recess that's been cut to, you know, academically focus these students, which is just developmentally, it's a hazard. Play is where you find students getting that foundation to be successful students, interpersonal skills, risk-taking skills, resilience, communication, all of these things that are truly important for kids to learn to be successful adults. We're taking that away. We're taking that away because we're so so worried about how these kids are going to look academically. So we're pushing it down to lower and lower grades, and that's having a consequence because it's not developmentally appropriate, and especially for boys, because not only are we pushing the academics down, we're also putting them in an environment that really is like a prison for them. It's frustrating to be in that environment and then being asked to do things you can't relate to.
We've heard from experts who solely focus on boys, Michael Gurian we've talked to, and to Leonard Sachs when he was here last year, Michael Thompson. All of them that have been saying that, you know, we know this stuff, we've known it for a very long time now, but the schools are very slow to catch up and actually do that. And you have so much pressure, as you've just mentioned, academically, and that's tied to money, and that's tied to all kinds of things that we are disadvantaging our children. How do we stop doing that now when you have the situation that we're looking at in Hawaii, aside from saying, I'm going to take my kid out of public school and stick him into private school?
Right. I think...
I mean, what can a parent do? Because not everybody can put their kid into a single-sex school.
Well, the fantastic thing is, in no way am I an expert on just the background with this research, but the fact is that the experts have found the information for us. I mean, there's definitely enough information. If we educate ourselves on this, it's a clear sign that things need to change. Now, at St. Andrews, we've realized this, and we're moving that way. So it's really a big part of it is educating parents, getting them to understand that their intuitions aren't always the best thing to be guiding our kids with. You know, we need to actually look at how do kids actually grow? What do we know? It may feel uncomfortable, but until we try it.
But you're talking about specifically, for parents of boys, because when you have a teacher telling you, well, your son wants to get up and walk around all the time, or when, parents can make lists longer than we even have time to talk about now. But for a lot of parents who are looking at this data and saying, wait a minute, I'm showing this to my teacher, I'm showing this to my school, and they don't seem to be taking notice of it. What can a parent do?
Bring them to the prep. I mean, that's not our approach, exactly what you're talking about.
No, but they can't. But my point is that for a parent who cannot possibly take a child out of public school and pop them into
a private
boys'
school. Yeah, absolutely. That
because they think that might be better for the child and instead are trying to make these points to the public school.
Right.
I mean, what else can they do if it falls on deaf ears?
Yeah. You know, and this is something Michael Thompson shared when he came to the school. Don't let your child be a child. Let them let them know what their passions are, and their skill strengths and their weaknesses. And that's allowing them. You need to allow students and your child to really choose activities they want to belong to. One thing, again, Michael Thompson said, why are we having kids doing hours of tutoring on weekends we want, in good intentions, to get academics going, but this shuts them off from school. I mean, this is a time for them to be finding out about themselves and what they're doing. So a few things is allowing kids to play, allowing kids to be creative, and giving them that space when you do have them at home, where you can actually start applying some of the research that we've seen yourselves at home. So
what you're really saying is that the parents need to pick up the ball and to create spaces for boys to be boys.
Yeah.
And let them choose some activities and not do a lot of activities that are academically oriented when they maybe should be playing.
Yeah, exactly. If you look just... biologically, that's how we've developed for a long time, boys. Traditionally, hunter-gatherer communities, boys learn by the adults modeling, and then the boys trying what the adults are doing in play, having debates, playing different games, testing the skills of what they'll need to be successful. And so really the fear that kids don't know... kids won't be able to educate themselves or motivate themselves to learn. I think that's a fallacy. We've got to, get corrected. I think so.
So you're really saying if we're able to engage a boy at the level
find what he's
of
interested
interest,
in, and then support that. Support his energy. Support his interests. Find creative ways to get those academic strengths you want to apply to boys. Really with them taking the lead. You're facilitating their education. And then they learn to be a lifelong learner. And that's really what it's about.
Which could be a little bit tougher for some helicopter parents, but you're saying off.
Yeah. Absolutely, Bethann.
All right. We're going to leave it there for a moment, but we'll have a town square about the differences in gender pretty soon. We'll have to bring everybody back and have a conversation.
Yeah,
it seems like it's time for those again.
A lot more to talk about.
Paul Burgess is the director of St. Andrews Preparatory School for Boys.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition Art Deco Hawaii, on view now through January 11th. More information at honolulumuseum.org.
Earlier, we talked a little bit about the start of the Matson Navigation Company and Captain William Matson. The company started in 1882 when Matson sailed the schooner Emma Claudina to Hawaii from San Francisco, full of goods, sailed back to the mainland with sugar. The success of his import-export business to the islands led to the founding of the Matson Navigation Company and also to other ventures such as oil and tourism. When Matson died, his fleet expanded from a schooner to 14 ships that carried both passengers and goods. And for the quiz, we wanted to know the year he died. If you said 1917, you're correct. William Matson died 97 years ago this month at the age of 67. It's 8:46, and that's our quiz. If you have one, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Straub Clinic and Hospital, a proud healthcare partner of University of Hawaii Athletics. Learn more at straubhealth.org.
Hawaii's rich tradition of hula was almost lost to us. Suppressed for generations, it was brought back to life only through the efforts of a few dedicated practitioners. The work of restoring the ancient tradition continues, and even those who think they know hula well, there's much to learn. Miley Lu Ching is the executive director of the Hula Preservation Society, which is holding a three-part cultural series as part of the upcoming 2014 International Waikiki Hula Conference, and she's with us in CR7 this morning. Good morning, Miley.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
You grew up in this tradition, yeah?
Yeah, you know, surrounded by hula and dance here in Hawaii and music. Can't get enough of it.
And by the time you were growing up, the tradition had already kind of been brought back to life, yeah?
Yeah, we had a lot more choices in the growing up in the 70s and 80s. So mm-hmm. There were halau that were active again. And during the time, the elders that we work with through Hula Preservation Society, it was really hula studios. And it was about teaching dance, but not how it is now with the whole shebang, our connection to the land and making your lei and dancing the ancient hula and focusing on that a lot.
Because the studio is about the movement, and of course there's plenty to learn there, mm-hmm. but is it there seems to be a growing appreciation of the larger picture.
Yeah, definitely, and around the world too, not just here in Hawaii. So that's what's wonderful about being in this Waikiki Hula Conference. It's very international, but we're able to, through Hula Preservation Society, bring our local people in to also appreciate the programs that we have, and because we have a lot to learn here in Hawaii too.
When you were learning, when you were younger, how was the story told to you about the whole suppression of hula? How was that presented to you?
It was a pretty simplified version. It was pretty much that the missionaries came, they banned the hula, Kalakaua brought it back, and therefore, you know, and it went underground, so those who had been keeping the traditions alive then could come out in the open again. It really isn't that simple. But that there is truth in that. But there were a lot more people who were advocating for the hula, who were carrying on the traditions within their own families, you know, away from the eyes of, you know, the powers that be that didn't want it to be practiced. But it was that's pretty much sums up what most kids, I think, learned in Hawaii about that.
Because it would be an oversimplification to say that it almost went extinct. It just sort of went
underground.
Went underground, and was kept alive as a family tradition.
Yeah, family traditions and also just, you know, communities. Because there used to be very distinct styles of by island, by part of the island, by family. Mm-hmm. It's not as distinctive today, but in the elders that we work with and talking with them, they could recognize where a dancer came from. And so that's really a beautiful thing about hula, because there was richness. It's not as homogenized as we may find today.
You hear that about slack key as well, that, oh, yeah, that's a Kauai style.
Yeah,
that's a Kauai
yeah.
tuning.
Because we were more isolated then.
Sure.
You know, from one valley to the next on one island, mm-hmm. you would have differences because it wasn't that easy to get around. You couldn't get from, you know, one island to the next, much less one part of the island to the other part of the island as much as you can now.
You know, you said earlier, Miley, that we in Hawaii still have much to learn about hula. What are the things you think are the most important to be emphasized?
Probably just how holistic it is, how much it has to offer any of us. It's not just people of Hawaiian blood, but it offers us a way to be active, stay healthy, to learn about this beautiful place that we live or that we love, even if we're not from here and we're studying hula across the seas. Mm-hmm. It has so much to offer us in terms of appreciating and taking care of the land, no matter where you live, that it's important to connect to that place, to honor the history of that place and the people and the values, and to help take care of it. And hula can bring all that to you, as well as just being vibrant and healthy and having that sense of aloha that you can live in. When you're living in the hula, you just have an automatic connection to that, because it puts you in a frame of mind that just keeps you focused on the positive.
It also focuses on community, in the sense that you're almost always with other dancers, right?
Yeah, definitely. You have your hula community, but then you're part of a larger community, and it just really it keeps your focus on those things that are really important to all of us, and that betters the community here in Hawaii, as well as, you know, the other dancers from around the world who are trying to capture even just a little bit of that, what we have here in the islands, that it gives them those lessons too. And it's all about aloha. Aloha for each other, aloha for yourself, aloha for the land.
Do you think that's what has a million people in Japan studying hula?
Well, I can't say from direct personal knowledge, but there is something that has captured their hearts.
Yeah.
I mean, not just in Japan. I mean, in Mexico, in Europe. And I think it's just that feeling of connectedness, because that's what we all want in life. You know, we want to feel connected. We want to feel a part of something that's important, that's bigger than all of us. And that's a way, hula is an amazing way to have those connections.
It would have to be something like that, yeah. Miley, because it can't just be another sort of exotic dance.
No, not at all. It just offers so much more, and I think these people are really getting a sense of that, and it's drawn them like no other. It's really amazing.
So this is this would be kind of the future of how hula is disseminated and preserved, I would think. That what you describe as the holistic
hopefully. View. I would hope so. I mean, there are so many teachers out there who are taking the time to travel the world and to share hula. So we hope that's what they're bringing, you know, that joy and that love for each other, for hula, and appreciation for Hawaii, because this is where the hula was born.
And it was more complex than we give it credit for being.
Definitely.
And that's the focus of some of your presentations at this next week. Yeah?
Right. We try to bring a variety of hula history and hula people to the fore through our work. And so we're trying to honor those who have come before us. In the 20th century, wasn't an easy time to be a hula practitioner, but yet there were those elders who have now passed on who were able to walk that line between perpetuating the ancient traditions and making a living. And that was what it was about when tourism was building up in the 20th century and Hawaii was becoming this destination. But they were able to navigate those waters. So we're honoring them, and we've been able to digitize some footage of these greats that hasn't been seen in public for many years.
Really?
So we're going to be sharing that and talking about them and just keeping their legacies alive. And then also sharing specifically about hula ki'i, which is a very interesting part of ancient hula.
Yeah.
Sometimes people think is Hawaiian puppetry is one way to describe it, a very simplified way to describe it, because mm-hmm. there's much more to hula ki'i. But sometimes people have the impression that must have been after the Westerners came here and they saw Western puppet shows or something. But that's mm-hmm. not true. It's written about in the very early accounts of visitors that they saw these performances. And so hula ki'i is a way, and just another way of telling stories, where you have either a puppet on your hand, or you're operating a puppet that's in front of you, or you yourself are the ki'i. Mm-hmm. You are the image. It's really fascinating. So we're happy to have an amazing panel of speakers for that program.
Because that's that becomes hula as theater and kind of linked to, you know, there are all these traditions of puppetry are using masks and figures,
right,
small figures around the world.
Exactly. And Hawaii had it too. And so it is theater, and hula is performance, but it is also much more than that. You know, it's our history, it's our people, it's our values, it's our place, all of that.
Do you feel that that understanding is growing among young people growing up in Hawaii today?
You know, there's definitely a different flavor to Hawaii in terms of if you really want to learn about Hawaiian culture and you really want to learn the language, there are so many more opportunities for you now. So yeah, I think there's more hope to that end, that hula is taken, is understood at a different level and appreciated at a deeper level.
The whole idea of understanding an earlier part of how your culture is, it's kind of central to being a practitioner in the modern world, yeah?
Yeah, definitely, because you have to know where you come from. If you haven't been exposed to the foundations, then you can't go and innovate without just making it up. So you have to look to the past. You have to look to the people who came before who have training, who have exposure in that. And in, for example, hula ki'i, there aren't many people who practice that today. And it's because it hasn't been carried on in their hula line. And so this is a chance for them to see performances from three of the most amazing hula ki'i practitioners that are around. So we're really excited to share.
It is exciting, yeah. Miley. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Miley Liu is the executive director of the Hula Preservation Society, and they're offering a three-part cultural series at the 2014 International Waikiki Hula Conference. Programs will take place November 7th, 8th, and 9th at the Hawaii Convention Center, and you can learn more at hpr2.org.
This week on Applause in a Small Room, we're featuring a jazz violin concert given by Dwayne Padilla with Tommy James, piano, and John Hawes, bass, in a concert tribute to the 1990s Stefan Grappelli and McCoy Tyner album, One on One. That's Dwayne Padilla and friends on Applause in a Small Room, Sunday at 4 p.m. on HPR2.
Today in the show, sorry, go ahead.
We had two kind of related conversations today, at least in our segments of the show, about preservation of Hawaiian culture and making it something that's offered to visitors in ways that it hasn't before.
And then what I was going to say is I think today we really focus on our culture in a lot of ways, what we teach our children, how we teach our kids. Do we differentiate enough between how boys and girls learn, and also our general culture being so tech oriented in so many ways. So how we go out there and live our lives, and all part of how we talked about today.
Much to think about.
And we're going to talk about more tomorrow. We hope you'll come back with us then, when we'll speak with national homelessness expert Matthew Daugherty. He's back in town. We will continue our conversation about the national initiatives at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness and how they're playing out in Hawaii.
And a flood of new music in an unlikely category, art song.
We want to hear from you. You can get to us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning for another look at the conversation. See you then.